barely for breath.
I did? How? I mean... Oh. Oh, God.
What did you say?
Her face was beautiful, so flushed that the color showed even by candlelight, her lips deep rose and wet.
I said, Oh, God.
A smile lit her shadowed face with happiness, and her already firm grip on him tightened. His shadow jerked.
Oh, good,
she said, and with a small triumphant crow of laughter, bent to slay him with her sharp white teeth. Ian and Rachel. Ian lifted the green gown off with a waft of fabric, and Rachel shook her head hard, shedding hairpins in all directions with little pinging sounds. She smiled at him, her dark hair coming damply down in chunks, and he laughed and plucked out a few more of the little wire hoops.
I thought I should die,
she said, running her fingers through her loosened hair, which Jenny had put up before the party at the White Camel Tavern.
Between the pins sticking into my head and the tightness of my stays. Unlace me, will thee, husband?
She turned her back to him, but looked over her shoulder, eyes dancing. He hadn't thought it possible to be more moved in his feelings or more excited in body, but that one word did both. He wrapped one arm around her middle, making her squeak, pulled the knot of her laces loose, and gently bit the back of her neck, making her squeak much louder. She struggled, and he laughed, holding her tighter as he loosened the laces. She was slim as a willow sapling, and twice as springy. She squirmed against him, and the small struggle heated his blood still further. If he had had no self-control, he would have had her pinned to the bed in seconds, stays and shift and stockings be damned. But he did, and let her go, easing the stay straps off her shoulders and the stays themselves over her head. She shook herself again, smoothing down the damp shift over her body, then stood tall, preening for him. Her nipples stood out hard against the limp fabric.
I won thy wager for thee, she said, passing a hand over the delicate blue satin ribbon threaded through the neck of her shift and fluttering the hem, adorned with embroidered flowers in blue and yellow and rose.
How did you hear about that?
He reached for her, pulled her close, and clasped both hands on her arse, bare under the shift.
Christ, you've got a sweet round wee bum.
Blasphemy on our wedding night.
But she was pleased, he could tell.
It's not blasphemy. It's a prayer of thanksgiving. And who told you about the wager?
Fergus had bet him a bottle of stout that a Quaker bride would have plain linen undergarments. He hadn't known himself, but had had hopes that Rachel wouldn't feel that pleasing her husband was the same thing as making a vain show for the world.
Germaine, of course.
She put her own arms around him and clasped him in similar manner, smiling up.
Thine is neither wee nor round, but no less sweet, I think. Does thee need help with thy fastenings?
He could tell she wanted to, so he let her kneel and unbutton the flies of his breeches. The sight of the top of her dark, dishevelled head, bowed earnestly to the task, made him put his hand gently on it, feeling her warmth, wanting the touch of her skin. His breeches fell, and she stood up to kiss him, her hand caressing his standing cock as though by afterthought.
Thy skin is so soft there, she said against his mouth, like velvet.
Her touch wasn't tentative, but very light, and he reached down and wrapped his fingers around hers, showing her the way of it, how to grasp it firmly and work it a bit.
I like it when thee moans, Ian,
she whispered, pressing closer and working it more than a bit.
I'm not mooning.
Yes, thee is.
I'm only breathing a bit. Here. I like that, but... Here.
Swallowing, he picked her up. She made a little whoop and carried her the two steps to the bed. He dropped her onto the mattress. She made a louder whoop and landed beside her, scooping her into his arms. There was a certain amount of writhing, giggling, and inarticulate noises, and she got him out of his calico shirt while he had her shift pulled up at the bottom and down at the top, but still puddled round her waist. "I win," she said, wiggling the wadded shift down over her hips and kicking it off.
"You think that, do you?"
He bent his head and took her nipple in his mouth. She made a very gratifying noise and clutched his head. He butted her gently under the chin, then lowered his head and sucked harder, flicking his tongue like an adder's.
"I like it when you moan, Rachel," he said, pausing for breath and grinning down at her. "Do you want me to make you scream?"
"Yes," she said, breathless, one hand on her wet nipple. "Please?"
"In a bit."
He'd paused to breathe, lifting himself above her to let a bit of air in between them. It was a small room and hot, and she reached up to feel his chest. She rubbed a thumb lightly over his nipple, and the sensation shot straight down to his cock. "Let me," she said softly, and lifted herself, a hand round his neck, and suckled him very gently.
"More,"
he said hoarsely, bracing himself against her weight.
"Harder. Teeth."
"Teeth," she blurted, letting go.
"Teeth,"
he said breathlessly, rolling onto his back and pulling her on top. She drew breath and lowered her head, hair spilling across his chest.
"Ow!"
"They said teeth," she sat up anxiously. "Oh, Ian, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt thee."
"You didn't. Well, you did, but... I mean, do it again, eh?"
She looked at him dubious, and it occurred to him that when Uncle Jamie told him to go slow and gentle with his virgin, it might not have been all to do with sparing the virgin.
"Here, money and done," he said, drawing her down beside him.
His heart was hammering and he was sweating. He brushed the hair back from her temple and nuzzled her ear.
"Slow for a bit, aye? Then I'll show you what I mean by teeth."
Ian smelled of wine and whiskey and musky male skin. He burned astonishingly under her hands, and smelled now something like a distant skunk, but in a much better way. She pressed her face into the curve of his shoulder, breathing him in with pleasure. She had his cock in her hand, gripping firmly, but curiosity made her loose her hold and grope lower, fingers probing through the thickness of his pubic hair. He breathed out very suddenly when she cupped his scrotum, and she smiled against his shoulder.
"Does thee mind, Ian?" she whispered,
rolling the lovely egg-like shapes of his balls in her palm. She'd seen male scrotum many times, baggy and wrinkled, and while she wasn't disgusted, had never thought them more than mildly interesting. This was wonderful, drawn up tight, the skin so soft and so hot. Daring, she scooted down a little and felt farther back between his legs. He had an arm about her shoulders and it tightened, but he didn't tell her to stop, instead spreading his legs a little, allowing her to explore him. She'd wiped men's asses hundreds of times, and the fleeting thought occurred to her that not all of them took great care. But his hair was curly and very clean, and her hips moved against him involuntarily as her fingertips slid tentatively between his buttocks. He twitched, tensing involuntarily, and she stopped, feeling him shiver. Then she realized that he was laughing, shaking silently.
"Am I tickling thee?"
she asked, raising up on one elbow. The light of the single candle flickered over his face, hollowing his cheeks and making his eyes shine as he smiled up at her.
"Aye, that's one word for it."
He ran a hand half roughly up her back and gripped her by the nape. He shook his head slowly, looking at her. His hair had come loose from its binding, and spread out dark behind his head.
"Here I am, trying to go slow, trying to be gentle. And the next thing I ken, you're squeezing my balls and sticking your fingers up my ass.
Is that wrong? She asked, feeling a slight qualm. I didn't mean to be, too bold.
He pulled her down and hugged her close.
You canna be too bold with me, lass,
he whispered in her ear, and ran his own hand down her back, and down farther. She gasped.
Shh,
he whispered, and went on slowly.
I thought you'd maybe be scared at first, but you're no scared a bit, are you?
I am. I'm terrified.
She felt the laughter bubble up through her chest, but there was some truth in it too, and he heard that. His hand stopped moving, and he drew back enough to look at her, squinting a little.
I? Well, not terrified exactly, but...
She swallowed, suddenly embarrassed.
I just... This is so nice. But I know when you... When we... Well, it does hurt the first time. I'm somewhat afraid that... Well, I don't want to stop what we're doing, but I'd like to get that part over with, so I needn't worry about it.
Over with?
He repeated. His mouth twitched a bit, but his hand was gentle on the small of her back.
Well, then.
He eased his other hand down and cupped her very delicately between the legs. She was swollen there, and slippery, had been growing more so ever since he'd lifted her gown off over her head. His fingers moved, one and then two, playing, stroking, and... It took her entirely by surprise, a feeling she knew but bigger, bigger, and then she gave way to it entirely, washed through with ecstasy. She settled slowly into limpness, throbbing.
Everywhere.
Ian kissed her lightly.
Well, that didn't take very long, did it?
He murmured.
Put your hands on my arms, Macrea, and hold on.
He moved over her, agile as a big cat, and eased his cock between her legs, sliding slow but firm.
Very firm.
She flinched, clenching involuntarily. But the way was slick, and her flesh swollen in welcome, and no amount of resistance would keep him out. She realized that her fingers were digging into his arms, but didn't let go.
Am I hurting you?
He said softly. He'd stopped moving, his full length inside her, stretching her in a most unnerving way.
Something had torn, she thought. It burned a little.
Yes, she said breathless. I don't mind.
He lowered himself very slowly and kissed her face, her nose, her eyelids lightly. And all the time the awareness of it, him, inside her. He pulled back a little and moved. She made a small breathless noise, not quite protest, a little pain, not quite encouragement. But he took it as that, and moved more strongly.
Dinna be worried, lass,
he said, a little breathless too.
I won't take long either. Not this time.
Rollo was snoring in the corner, lying on his back for coolness, legs folded like a bug's. She tasted faintly sweet, of her own musk, and a trace of blandness with an animal tang that he recognized as his own seed. He buried his face in her, breathing deep, and the slight salt taste of blood made him think of trout fresh caught and barely cooked, the flesh hot and tender, pink and slick in his mouth. She jerked in surprise and arched up into him, and he tightened his hold on her, making a low mmm of reassurance. It was like fishing, he thought dreamily, hands under her hips, feeling with your mind for the sleek dark shape just under the surface, letting the fly come down just so. She drew her breath in hard, and then engagement, the sudden sense of startlement, then a fierce awareness as the line sprang taut, you and the fish so focused on each other that there was nothing else in the world.
Oh, God,
he whispered, and ceased to think, only feeling the small movements of her body, her hands on his head, the smell and taste of her, and her feelings washed through him with her murmured words.
I love thee, Ian.
And there was nothing else in the world but her. Jamie and Claire. The light of a low yellow half-moon shone through gaps in the trees, glimmering on the dark rushing waters of the Delaware. So late at night the air was cool by the river, very welcome to faces and bodies heated by dancing, feasting, drinking, and generally being in close proximity to 100 or so other hot bodies for the last 6 or 7 hours. The bridal couples had escaped fairly early, Denzel and Dotty very inconspicuously, Ian and Rachel to the raucous shouts and indelicate suggestions of a roomful of festive wedding guests. Once they'd left, the party had settled down to serious merrymaking, the drinking now unhampered by the interruption of wedding toasts. We'd taken our leave of the Grey brothers. Hal, as father of one of the brides, was hosting the party sometime after midnight. Hal had been sitting in a chair near a window, very drunk, and wheezing slightly from the smoke, but sufficiently composed as to stand and bow over my hand. "You want to go home," I advised him, hearing the faint squeak of his breathing over the winding-down noises of the party. "Ask John if he's got any more ganja, and if he does, smoke it. It will do you good." And not only in a physical way, I thought.
"I thank you for your kind advice, madam," he said dryly.
And too late, I recalled our conversation the last time he'd been exposed to ganja. His worry over his son Benjamin. If he thought of it too, though, he said nothing, and merely kissed my hand and nodded to Jamie in farewell. John had stood by his brother's side most of the evening, and stood behind him now as we took our leave. His eyes met mine briefly, and he smiled, but didn't step forward to take my hand. Not with Jamie at my shoulder. I wondered now, briefly, if I should ever see either of the Greys again. We hadn't gone back to the print shop, but had wandered down by the river, enjoying the coolness of the night air, and chatting about the young couples and the excitements of the day.
"I imagine their nights are being a bit more exciting still," Jamie remarked. "Reckon the lasses will be sore come morning. Poor wee things."
"Oh, it may not be just the girls," I said, and he sniffed with amusement.
"I will. You may be right about that. I seem to recall waking the next morning after our wedding and wondering for a moment whether I'd been in a fight. Then I saw you in the bed wi' me, and knew I had."
"Didn't slow you down any,"
I remarked, dodging a pale stone in my path. "I seem to recall being rather rudely awakened next morning."
"Rude? I was very gentle with you. More than you were with me," he added, a distinct grin in his voice. "I told Ian so."
"You told Ian what?"
"Well, he wanted advice, and so I..."
"Advice? Ian?"
To my certain knowledge, the boy had begun his sexual career at the age of 14, with a prostitute of similar age in an Edinburgh brothel, and hadn't looked back. Besides his Mohawk wife, there were at least half a dozen other liaisons that I knew of, and I was sure I didn't know them all.
"Aye, he wanted to know how to deal kindly with Rachel, her being virgin. Something new to him,"
he added wryly. I laughed. "Well, they'll be having an interesting night of it then, all of them." I told him about Dottie's request in camp, Rachel's advent, and our ad hoc session of premarital counselling.
"You told them what?"
He snorted with amusement.
"You make me say, oh God, all the time, Sassenach. And it's mostly not to do we bed at all."
"I can't help it if you're naturally disposed to that expression," I said. "You do say it in bed with no little frequency. You even said it on our wedding night. Repeatedly, I remember."
"Well, little wonder, Sassenach, with all the things you did to me on our wedding night."
"What I did to you?" I said, indignant. "What on earth did I do to you?"
"You bit me,"
he said instantly.
Oh, I did not.
Where?
Here and there, he said evasively, and I elbowed him.
Oh, all right. You bit me on the lip when I kissed you.
I don't recall doing that at all, I said, eyeing him. His features were invisible, but the moon glow off the water as he walked cast his bold, straight-nosed profile in silhouette.
I remember you kissing me for quite a long time while you were trying to unbutton my gown, but I'm sure I didn't bite you then.
No, he said thoughtfully, and ran a hand lightly down my back.
It was later, after I went out to fetch you some food, and Rupert and Murtaugh and the rest all chaffed me. I know, because it was when I drank some of the wine I'd fetched back. I noticed it burned the cut in my lip. And I bedded you again before I got round to the wine, so it must have been that time.
Ha, I said. By that time you wouldn't have noticed if I'd bitten your head off like a praying mantis. You'd got it properly up your nose and thought you knew everything.
He put an arm round my shoulders, pulled me close, and whispered in my ear.
I'd got it properly up you and Ian, and you weren't noticing all that much yourself, besides what was going on between your legs.
Rather hard to ignore that sort of carry-on, I said primly. He gave the breath of a laugh, and stopping under a tree, gathered me in and kissed me. He had a lovely soft mouth.
Well, I will not deny you taught me my business, Sassenach, he murmured, and you made a good job of it.
You caught on reasonably quickly, I said. Natural talent, I suppose.
If it was a matter of special training, Sassenach, the human race would have died out long since.
He kissed me again, taking more time over it.
Do you think Denny kens what he's about? He asked, letting go. He's a virtuous wee man, aye?
Oh, I'm sure he knows everything he needs to, I protested. He's a physician, after all.
Jamie gave a cynical laugh.
Aye, while he may see the odd whore now and then, it's likely in the way of his profession, not hers. Besides...
He moved close, and putting his hands through the pocket slits in my skirt, took a firm and interesting grip on my bottom.
Do they teach you in medical college how to spread your wife's wee hams and lick her from tailbone to navel?
I didn't teach you that one.
Indeed you didn't. And you're a physician, no?
That...
I'm sure that doesn't make any sense. Are you drunk, Jamie?
Dinner ken, he said, laughing. I'm sure you are, Sassenach.
Let's go home, he whispered, leaning close and drawing his tongue up the side of my neck.
I want you to make me say, oh God, for you.
That could be arranged. I'd cooled down during our walk, but the last 5 minutes had lit me like a candle. And if I'd wanted to go home and take off my stays before... I was now wondering whether I could wait that long.
Good, he said, pulling his hands out of my skirt. And then I'll see what I can make you say, Monian Dun.
See if you could make me say, don't stop.
Part 6. The Ties That Bind. Chapter 95. The Body Electric. Redondo Beach, California, December the 5th, 1980. If she hadn't needed stamps, she wouldn't have stopped in at the post office. She'd have clipped this batch of letters to the mailbox for the postman to collect, or posted them in the corner mailbox when she took the kids down to the beach to look for pelicans. But she did need stamps. There were at least a dozen more niggling things to deal with. Things needing notarization or photocopies or tax returns or... S-word, she muttered, sliding out of the car. Bloody F-wording S-word. This was small relief to her feelings of anxiety and oppression. It really wasn't fair. Who needed the relief of occasional bad language more than a mother of small children? Maybe she should start using her mother's Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ instead.
Jem had incorporated that one into his own collection of expletives before he turned 4, and had long since taught it to Mandy. They wouldn't be warped by hearing it. It hadn't been this hard last time. Well, no, she corrected herself. It had been a lot harder, in the most important respect. But this quagmire of pettifogging details. Property, bank accounts, leases, notifications. She flicked the sheaf of sealed envelopes in her hand against her thigh with irritation. Some day she would have taken Jem and Mandy by their hands and run, not walked, straight into the stones, with no feeling save relief at abandoning all this bloody stuff. She hadn't really had much stuff when she did it the first time, and of course she'd had someone to leave it with. Her heart squeezed a little, remembering the day she'd nailed down the lid on the wooden shipping crate that held her family's modest history. The silver passed down through her father's family, cabinet photographs of her mother's parents, the collection of her father's first editions, her mother's World War II Queen Alexandra uniform cap, still with a faint but detectable odour of iodine about it, and taken such pains in writing the note to Roger to go with it. You told me once that everyone needs a history. This is mine. Almost sure, then, that she'd never see Roger again, let alone the silverware. She blinked hard and shoved the door of the post office open with so much force that it crashed into the wall, and everyone in the lobby turned to stare at her. Hot-faced, she grabbed the doorframe and closed it with exaggerated care, then crossed the lobby soft-footed, avoiding all eyes. She shoved the envelopes through the collection box slot, one by one, with a certain feeling of grim satisfaction at each tedious thing disposed of. Preparing to disappear into the past, leaving all stuff behind, was one thing. Preparing to disappear while thinking that you might eventually come back and need that stuff again, or that your children might come back 20 years later without you. She swallowed. That was something else again, as her father was inclined to say. She couldn't just dump it all on Uncle Joe. He didn't... She turned, glancing across the lobby automatically at her P.O. box, and stopped, seeing the letter. She felt the hairs rising on her forearm as she strode across the grubby linoleum and reached for the knob, even before her mind had consciously registered the fact that it didn't look like a utility bill, a credit card application, or any other sort of official mail. G-H-I-D-E-I. The tumblers of the combination lock fell, and the heavy little door swung open. And right there, in the post office, she smelled heather and peat smoke, and the breath of the mountains so strongly that her eyes blurred and her own breath caught in her throat. It was a regular white envelope addressed to her in Joe Abernethy's round, capable hand. She could feel something inside it, another envelope, this one with a lump on it, a seal of some kind. She made it to her rented car before ripping it open. It wasn't an envelope, but a sheet of paper folded and sealed with wax, blurs of black ink bleeding through the paper where a quill had scratched too deep. An 18th-century letter. She pressed it to her face, inhaling, but the scent of smoke and heather was gone, if it had ever been there. It smelled now only of age and brittle paper. Not even the tang of the iron gall ink was left. There was a brief note from Uncle Joe, a slip of paper folded next to the letter. "Bree, darling, hope this catches you in time. It came from the estate agent in Scotland. He said when the new tenant at Lallybroch went to put the furniture in storage, they couldn't get that big old desk through the door of the study. So they called an antiques guy to take the thing apart, very carefully, he assured me. And when they did, they found 3 Queen Victoria stamps, and this." I didn't read it. "If you haven't left yet, let me know if you want the stamps. Lenny Jr. collects them and will give them a good home, if not. All my love, Uncle Joe." She folded the note carefully, pressing the creases, tucking it into her handbag. She felt as though she ought to go somewhere else to read the letter, somewhere private and quiet, so she could go to pieces without anyone noticing. The seal was sooty grey candle wax, not sealing wax, and Roger had sealed it with his thumbprint. It wasn't necessary. She'd recognize the writing immediately. But there was no doubt of the tiny hook-shaped scar left when a scaling knife had slipped while he was cleaning a salmon he and Jem had caught in Loch Ness. She'd kissed it while the cut was healing, and a dozen times since. But she couldn't wait, and hands trembling, opened her pocket knife and carefully pried off the seal, trying not to break it. It was old and brittle. The candle grease had seeped into the paper over the years, making a shadow around the glob of wax, and it shattered in her hand. She clutched the fragments convulsively and turned the folded paper over. "Brianna Randall Fraser Mackenzie," he'd written on the front, "to be kept until called for." That made her laugh, but the sound came out as a sob, and she dashed the back of her hand across her eyes, desperate to read. The very first words made her drop the letter as though it were on fire. "November the 15th, 1739. She snatched it back up. Lest she somehow miss it, he'd underlined 1739. "How in bloody hell did you..." she said aloud, and clapped a hand over her mouth, where she kept it as she read the rest. "My dearest heart, I know what you're thinking, and I don't know. My best idea is that I've come in search of Jeremiah and found him, or may have found him, but not the person I thought I was looking for. I sought help at Lallybroch, where I met Brian Fraser. You would like him, and he you. And through him, with the assistance of one Captain Jack Randall, of all people, came into possession of a set of RAF identification discs. I recognize the information on them. We, Buck is still with me, have been searching for Jem since our arrival and have found no sign at all. I won't give up. Of course you know that. But as our inquiries have borne no fruit in the northern clan lands, I feel I must follow the one clue I have and see if I can locate the owner of those tags. I don't know what might happen, and I had to leave you some word, however faint the chance that you'll ever see it. God bless you, and Jem, wherever he is, poor little guy, and I can only hope and pray he's safe. And my sweet Mandy. I love you. I'll love you forever. R. She didn't realize that she was crying until the tears running down her face tickled her hand. "Oh, Roger," she said. "Oh, dear God." In the late evening, with the kids safely asleep and the sound of the Pacific Ocean washing through the open balcony doors, Brianna took out a bound notebook, brand new, and a Fisher space pen, guaranteed to write upside down, underwater, and in conditions of zero gravity, which she thought entirely appropriate to this particular piece of composition. She sat down under a good light, paused for a moment, then got up and poured a glass of cold white wine, which she set on the table beside her notebook. She'd been composing bits of this in her mind all day, and so began with no difficulty. There was no telling how old the kids might be when or if they read it, so she made no effort to simplify things. It wasn't a simple matter. A Practical Guide for Time Travellers, Part 2. Right. Dad's written down what we think we know about this, in terms of observation of occurrence, physical effects, and morality. This next part could be best described as preliminary hypotheses of cause, how time travel might work. I'd call it the scientific part, but you can't actually apply the scientific method very far with the scanty data we have available. Any scientific approach starts with observations, though, and we have enough of those to maybe construct a rough series of hypotheses. Testing those...
The idea of testing those made Brianna's hand shake so badly that she was obliged to set down her pen and breathe slowly for 2 or 3 minutes, until the black spots stopped swarming in front of her eyes. Gritting her teeth, she wrote, Hypothesis 1. That the time passages, /vortices, /whatever-the-bloody-hell-they-are, are caused by or occur at the crossing of ley lines, defined here as lines of geomagnetic force, rather than the folkloric definition of straight map lines drawn between ancient structures like hill forts, henges, or places of ancient worship, like saints' pools. Supposition is that folkloric lines may be identical or parallel with geomagnetic lines, but no hard evidence to this effect. Evidence in support of hypothesis? Some. But to start with, we don't know whether the standing stones are part of the vortex thingy, or just markers set up when ancient people saw other ancient people step on the grass, right, there, and poof. Poof, she muttered to herself, and reached for the glass of wine. She'd planned to drink it as a reward when she'd finished, but at the moment felt more in need of first aid than reward. I wish it was just poof. One sip, two, and then she set it down, the citric edge of the wine lingering pleasantly on her tongue. Where were we? Oh, poof. Dad was able to connect a lot of the folkloric lays to standing stone circles. It would theoretically be possible to check the geomagnetic polarity of the rock around standing stone circles. That should actually go some way towards supporting Hypothesis 1, but might be a little difficult to execute. That is, you can measure the Earth's magnetic field. Carl Friedrich Gauss figured out how to do it back in 1835 or so. But it isn't the sort of thing individuals do much. Governments that do geological surveys have the equipment for it. I know the British Geological Survey's Eskdale Muir Observatory does, because I saw a write-up on them. And I quote, such observatories can measure and forecast magnetic conditions such as magnetic storms that sometimes affect communications, electric power, and other human activities. Other human activities, she muttered. Right. The army does this sort of thing too, she wrote as an afterthought. Yes, I'll get the army right on that. The pen hovered over the page as she thought, but she couldn't add anything else useful there, so went on. Hypothesis 2. That entering a time vortex with a gemstone, preferably faceted, vide remarks made by Gillis Duncan to this effect, offers some protection to the traveller in terms of physical effect. Query. Why facets? We used mostly unfaceted ones coming back through Ocracoke, and we know of other travellers using plain unfaceted ones. Speculation. Joe Abernathy told me about one of his patients, an archaeologist, who told him about some study done on standing stones up in Orkney, where they discovered that the stones have interesting tonal qualities. If you strike them with wooden sticks or other stones, you get a kind of musical note. Any kind of crystal, and all gems have a crystalline interior structure, has a characteristic vibration when struck. That's how quartz watches work. So, what if the crystal you carry has vibrations that respond to, or stimulate, for that matter, vibrations in the standing stones nearby? And if they did, what might be the physical effect? DBK asterisk. She made a swift note at the bottom of the page, asterisk DBK, don't bloody know, and returned to her writing. Evidence. There really isn't any, other than the aforesaid remarks from Gillis Duncan, though she may have noted some anecdotal material in her journals, which you'll find in the large safe deposit box at the Royal Bank of Scotland in Edinburgh. Uncle Joe will have the key, or will have made provisions for you to get it. N.B. Granny Clare travelled the first 2 times without any stones, though note that she was wearing a gold wedding ring the first time, and a gold and a silver ring on the second journey. Granny said that going with a stone seemed slightly easier, but given the subjectivity of the experience, I don't know how much weight to put on that. Doing it with a stone is the most horrible thing. I better not say that. She hesitated for some time, but after all, her own experiences were data, and given how little there was of it. She finished the sentence, then went on. Hypothesis 3, that travelling with a gemstone allows one better control in choosing where/when to emerge. She stopped frowning and crossed out where. There wasn't any indication of people travelling between sites. Be bloody handy if they could, though. She sighed and went on. Evidence. Pretty sketchy, owing to a lack of data. We know of a few travellers other than ourselves, and of these, 5 Native Americans, part of a political group called the Montauk Five, travelled with the use of stones. One of these is known to have died in the attempt, one survived and travelled back about 200 years, and another, a man named Robert Springer, a.k.a. Ottertooth, travelled back more than the usual distance, arriving approximately 250 to 260 years prior to his year of departure. We don't know what happened to the 2 other members of this group. They may have travelled to a different time, and we haven't found any mention of them. Difficult to track down a time traveller if you don't know when they may have gone, what their real names are, or what they look like. May have been blown out of the time vortex for unknown reasons, or may have died inside it. That little possibility unnerved her so much that she set down the pen and took several large swallows of wine before resuming. By the evidence of Ottertooth's journal, these men all did travel with gemstones, and he procured a large opal with which he intended to make the return trip. This is the stone Jemmy made explode in North Carolina, presumably because fire opals have a high water content. It hadn't, and thinking back, she couldn't imagine how it hadn't, occurred to her at the time to see whether Jemmy could make water boil by touching it. Well, she could see why it hadn't occurred to her, in retrospect. The last thing she'd wanted was any more dangerous peculiarity near her children, much less dangerous peculiarities being inherent in them. I wonder how often it happens that 2 time travellers marry each other, she said aloud. No telling what the frequency of the gene, if it was a gene, but that looked to be a decent bet, in the general population was. But it couldn't be very common, or people would be walking into Stonehenge and Callanish and going poof on a daily basis. Somebody would have noticed, she concluded, and sat twiddling the pen for a bit in meditation. Might she have met and married Roger if it weren't for the time-travelling thing? No, because it was her mother's need to find out what had happened to the men of Lallybroch that had led them to Scotland. Well, I'm not sorry, she said aloud to Roger, in spite of everything. She flexed her fingers and picked up the pen, but didn't write at once. She hadn't thought further with her hypotheses, and wanted them to be clear in her mind, at least. She had vague notions about how a time vortex might be explained in the context of a unified field theory, but if Einstein couldn't do it, she didn't think she was up to it right this minute. It has to be in there somewhere, though, she said aloud, and reached for the wine. Einstein had been trying to form a theory that dealt both with relativity and electromagnetism. And plainly they were dealing with relativity here, but a sort in which it maybe wasn't the speed of light that was limiting. What then? The speed of time? The shape of time? Did electromagnetic fields crisscrossing in some places warp that shape? What about the dates? Everything they thought they knew, precious little as it was,
indicated that travel was easier, safer, on the sun feasts and fire feasts, the solstices and equinoxes. A little ripple ran up her back. A few things were known about standing stone circles, and one of the common things was that many had been built with astronomical prediction in mind. Was the light striking a specific stone the signal that the Earth had reached some planetary alignment that affected the geomagnetism of that area?
"Ah," she said, and sipped, flipping back over the pages she'd written. What a hodgepodge. This wouldn't do anyone much good. Nothing but disconnected thoughts, and things that didn't even qualify as decent speculation. Still, her mind wouldn't let go of the matter. Electromagnetism. Bodies had electric fields of their own, she knew that much. Was that maybe why you didn't just disintegrate when you travelled? Did your own field keep you together just long enough to pop out again? She supposed that might explain the gemstone thing. You could travel on the strength of your own field if you were lucky. But the energy released from the molecular bonds in a crystal might well add to that field. So perhaps... Bugger, she said, her overworked mental processes creaking to a halt. She glanced guiltily at the hallway that led to the kids' room. They both knew that word, but they oughtn't to think their mother did. She sank back to finish the wine and let her mind roam free, soothed by the sound of the distant surf. Her mind wasn't interested in water, though. It still seemed concerned with electricity. "I sing the body electric," she said softly. "The armies of those I love engirth me." Now there was a thought. Maybe Walt Whitman had been onto something, because if the electric attraction of the armies of those I love had an effect on time travelling, it would explain the apparent effect of fixing your attention on a specific person, wouldn't it? She thought of standing in the stones of Craignadun, thinking of Roger, or of standing on Ocracoke, mind fixed fiercely on her parents. She'd read all the letters now. She knew exactly where they were. Would that make a difference? An instant's panic as she tried to visualize her father's face, more as she groped for Roger's. The expression of the face balks the count. The next line echoed soothingly in her head. But the expression of a well-made man appears not only in his face. It is in his limbs and joints also. It is curiously in the joints of his hips and wrists. It is in his walk, the carriage of his neck, the flex of his waist and knees. Dress does not hide him. The strong, sweet, supple quality he has strikes through the cotton and flannel. To see him pass conveys as much as the best poem, perhaps more. You linger to see his back, and the back of his neck and shoulder side. She didn't remember any more, but didn't need to. Her mind had calmed. "I'd know you anywhere," she said softly to her husband, and lifted the remains of her glass. "Slanja." Chapter 96.
"Nae great shortage of hair in Scotland."
Mr. Cumberpatch proved to be a tall, ascetic person with an incongruous crop of red curls that sat on his head like a small, inquisitive animal. He had, he said, taken the discs in trade for a sucking pig, along with a tin pan whose bottom had been burnt through but could easily be patched, 6 horseshoes, a looking-glass, and 1/2 a dresser.
"Not really a tinker by trade, see," he said. "Don't travel much. But things come and find me, they do."
Evidently they did. Mr. Cumberpatch's tiny cottage was crammed to its rafters with items that had once been useful, and might be so again, once Mr. Cumberpatch got round to fixing them.
"So much?" Buck asked,
raising an eyebrow at a disassembled carriage clock that sat on the hearth, its internal organs neatly piled into a worn silver comfit dish.
"Happen," Mr. Cumberpatch said laconically. "See anything you like."
In the interests of cooperation, Roger haggled politely for a dented canteen and a canvas bedsack with only a few small charred holes at one end. These the result of some soldier taking his rest too close to a campfire, and received in turn the name and general direction of the person from whom Mr. Cumberpatch had got the discs.
"Flimsy sort of jewel," his host said with a shrug, "and the old woman said she wouldn't have it in the house. All those numbers might be to do with magic, aye? Her not holding with sorcery and the like."
The old woman in question was possibly 25, Roger thought. A tiny, dark-eyed creature, like a vole, who, summoned to provide tea, seized them up with a shrewd glance, and proceeded to sell them a small, flabby-looking cheese, 4 turnips, and a large raisin tart, at an extortionate price. But the price included her own observations on her husband's transaction. Well worth it, so far as Roger was concerned.
"That ornament... strange thing, no?" she said, narrowing her eyes at the pocket where Roger had replaced it. "And what sold it to Anthony said he'd had it from a hairy man, one of them as lives on the wall."
"Which wall would this be, Mrs.?" Buck asked, draining his cup and holding it out for more. She gave him a look from her bead-bright eyes, obviously thinking him a simpleton, but they were paying customers, after all.
"Why, the Roman one, to be sure," she said. "They say the old king of the Romans put it up so as to keep the Scots from coming into England."
The thought made her grin, small teeth gleaming.
"As though anybody'd want to be going there in the first place."
Further questions elicited nothing more. Mrs. Cumberpatch had no idea what was meant by a hairy man. That was what the man said, and she hadn't wondered about it. Declining an offer from Mr. Cumberpatch for his knife, Roger and Buck took their leave, the food wrapped in the bedsack. But as they did so, Roger saw a pottery dish containing a tangle of chains and tarnished bracelets, and a stray gleam of rainy light struck a tiny red glow. It must have been Cumberpatch's description of the discs as a jewel, a common way to refer to a pendant ornament that had made his mind sensitive. He stopped, and, stirring the dish with a forefinger, drew out a small pendant, blackened, cracked, and with a broken chain. It looked as though it had been in a fire, but set with a fairly large garnet, caked with grime, but faceted.
"How much for this?" he said.
It was dark by 4 o'clock. And long cold nights to be sleeping out of doors. But Roger's sense of urgency drove them on, and they found themselves benighted on a lonely road, with nothing but a wind-gnarled Caledonian pine for shelter. Starting a fire with tinder and damp pine needles was no joke. But after all, Roger reflected, grimly bashing steel and flint for the 100th time, and his finger for the 20th, they had nothing but time. Buck had, with a forethought born of painful experience, brought a sack of peats, and after a quarter hour of frantic blowing on sparks and thrusting grass stems and pine needles into the infant flame, they succeeded in getting two of these miserable objects to burn with sufficient heat as to roast, or at least sear, the turnips and warm their fingers, if not the rest of them. There hadn't been any conversation since they'd left the Cumberpatch establishment. Impossible to talk with the cold wind whistling past their ears as they rode, and no breath with which to do it during the struggle with fire and food.
"What'll you do if we find him?" Buck asked suddenly, mid-turnip. "If J.W. Mackenzie really is your father, I mean." "I expect..."
Roger's throat was clogged from the cold, and he coughed and spat, resuming hoarsely,
"Spent the last 3 days wondering that, and the answer is, I don't know."
Buck grunted and unwrapped the raisin tart from the bedsack, divided it carefully, and handed Roger half.
It wasn't bad,
though Mrs. Cumberpatch couldn't be said to have a light hand with pastry.
"Filling," Roger remarked, thriftily dabbing crumbs off his coat and eating them.
"Do you not want to go, then?"
Buck shook his head.
"Nay, I cannot think of anything better to do. As you say, it's the only clue there is, even if it doesn't seem to have aught to do with the wee lad."
"Mm-hmm. And there's the one good thing. We can head straight south to the wall. We needn't waste time looking for the man Cumberpatch got the discs from."
"Aye," Buck said dubiously. "And then what? Walk the length of it, asking after a hairy man? How many of those do you think there might be? Nay great shortage of hair in Scotland, I mean."
"If we have to," Roger said shortly. "But if J.W. Mackenzie, and not just his identity discs, was anywhere in the neighbourhood, I'm thinking he would have caused a good bit of talk."
"Mm-hmm. And how long is this wall, do you know?"
"I do, yes. Or rather,"
Roger corrected, "I know how long it was when it was built. 80 Roman miles. A Roman mile being just slightly shorter than an English one. No idea how much of it's still there, though. Most of it, likely."
Buck grimaced.
"Well, say we can walk 15-20 miles in a day. The walking will be easy if it's along a bloody wall. That's only 4 days to cover the lot. Though,"
a thought struck him, and he frowned, pushing his damp forelock back.
"That's if we could walk from end to end. If we hit it midway, though, what then? We might cover half and find nothing, and then have to go all the way back to where we started."
He looked accusingly at Roger. Roger rubbed a hand over his face. It was coming on to rain, and the mizzle was misting on his skin.
"I'll think about it tomorrow, aye," he said. "We'll have plenty of time to make plans on our way."
He reached for the canvas bedsack, shook out a limp turnip frond and ate it, then pulled the sack over his head and shoulders.
"Want to join me under this, or are ye for bed?"
"Nay, I'm all right."
Buck pulled his slouch hat lower and sat hunched, toes as close to the remnants of the fire as he could get. Roger drew his knees up and tucked in the ends of the bedsack. The rain made a gentle pittering on the canvas, and in the fatigue of exhaustion and cold, but with the comfort of a full stomach, he allowed himself the further comfort of imagining Bree. He did this only at night, but looked forward to it with a greater anticipation than he did supper. He envisioned her in his arms, sitting between his knees, her head lying back on his shoulder, snug under the canvas with him, and her soft hair spangled with raindrops that caught the faint light of the fire. Warm, solid, breathing against his chest, his heart slowing down to beat with hers.
"I wonder what I'd say to my own father," Buck said suddenly. "Had I ever kent him, I mean."
He blinked at Roger from under the shadowed brim of his hat.
Does he know about you?"
Roger suppressed his annoyance at being disturbed in his fantasy, but answered shortly,
"Yes, I was born before he disappeared."
"Oh."
Buck rocked back a little, looking meditative, but said no more. Roger found, though, that the interruption had made his wife vanish. He concentrated, trying to bring her back, imagining her in the kitchen at Lallybroch, the steam of cooking rising up around her, making wisps of red hair curl round her face, and moisture gleam on the long straight bridge of her nose. What he was hearing, though, was her arguing with him about whether he should tell Buck the truth of his begetting. "Don't you think he has a right to know?" she'd said. "Wouldn't you want to know something like that?"
"Actually, I don't think I would," he'd said at the time. "But now..."
"Do you know who your father was?"
Roger asked suddenly. The question had been in his mind for months. He unsure whether he had any right to ask it. Buck gave him a baffled, faintly hostile glance.
"What the devil do you mean by that?"
"Of course I do. Or did. He's dead now.
His face twisted suddenly, realizing.
Or maybe not, since you're not born yet. Aye, it gets you after a bit, doesn't it?
Apparently, it had just gotten to Buck. He stood up abruptly and stalked off. He stayed gone for a good 10 minutes, giving Roger time to regret saying anything. But at last, Buck came out of the dark and sat down again by the smouldering peat. He sat with his knees pulled up, arms locked round them.
"What did you mean by that?" he asked abruptly. "Did I ken my father and that?"
Roger took in a deep breath of damp grass, pine needles, and peat smoke.
"I mean, you weren't born to the house you grew up in. Did you ken that?"
Buck looked wary and slightly bewildered.
"Aye," he said slowly. "Or not kent it straight out, I mean. My parents didn't have any bairns beside me, so I thought there was maybe... Well, I thought I was likely a bastard born to my father's sister. She died, they said, about the time I was born, and she wasn't a merit, so..."
He shrugged, one-shouldered.
"So, no."
He turned his head and looked at Roger, expressionless.
"How do you come to know yourself?" "Brianna's mother."
He felt a sharp, sudden longing for Claire, and was surprised at it.
"She was a traveller, but she was at Leoch about that time, and she told us what happened."
He had the hollow-bellied feel of one about to jump off a precipice into water of unknown depth. But there was no way to stop now.
"Your father was Dougal Mackenzie of Castle Leoch, war chieftain of the clan Mackenzie. And your mother was a witch named Gillis."
Buck's face was absolutely blank, the faint firelight shimmering on the broad cheekbones that were his father's legacy. Roger wanted suddenly to go and take the man in his arms, smooth the hair back from his face, comfort him like a child. Like the child he could so plainly see in those wide, stunned green eyes. Instead, he got up and went off into the night, giving his 4 times great-grandfather what privacy he could in which to deal with the news. It hadn't hurt. Roger woke coughing, and drops of moisture rolled tickling down his temples, dislodged by the motion. He was sleeping under the empty canvas bed sack rather than on it, valuing its water resilience more than its potential comfort when stuffed with grass, but he hadn't been able to bear having it over his head. He put a hand cautiously to his throat, feeling the thickened line of the rope scar cutting across the lower swell of his larynx. He rolled over, lifted himself on one elbow, and cleared his throat experimentally. It didn't hurt this time either.
"Do you know what a hyoid bone is?"
He did, as a result of a number of medical consultations about his damaged voice. He understood the anatomy of his throat quite well. And thus had known what Dr. McEwen meant. His own hyoid was placed slightly higher and farther back than the usual, a fortunate circumstance that had saved his life when he was hanged, as the crushing of that wee bone would have suffocated him. Had he been dreaming of McEwen? Or of being hanged?
Yes, that.
He'd had dreams like that often in the months afterward, though they'd grown less frequent in later years. But he remembered looking up through the lacy branches of the tree, seeing, in the dream, the rope tied to the branch above him, and the desperate struggle to scream a protest through the gag in his mouth. Then the ineluctable sliding under him as the horse he sat on was led away.